by existence. You're all immune to that, are you? No. No. This is more primordial than the entire tarot deck. This is an occurrence for which there is no correlate. There's nothing cognate. Notice here, notice the precision. There is nothing correlate or cognate with this experience. So that the whole process of searching for what has done this, when it is successful, reveals the fact that there is nothing that did this. Does this mean that that whole quest then was meaningless? No, not at all. It means that that whole quest is a mystery. And that the successful conclusion of the quest was that one found that there was nothing in particular that did this to you. Make it less mysterious. Whatever happened to you in a whole way and was not any particular thing that just happened to you, but it was the wholeness of yourself that occurred. You blinked into completeness for a moment and it stunned your ignorant life self. It stunned the marionette puppet that thinks that it's you into stopping for a moment because all of the energy went to the real you and the little marionette actions for a moment shorted out and didn't happen, didn't occur. So when the puppet movement started again, there's like this weird, delicate, yet penetrating flavor that something happened. What was it? It's like the strongest deja vu, only the deja vu is that nothing happened. Yeah, it's a very peculiar flavor. It's weird. And it's not derived from my name. It's just weird. It has a weird flavor to it. Because the conviction of your everyday self is that something strange has happened. And thus one looks for the cause. And so the second one is seeing the traces. Seeing the traces. Now the ox, as Suzuki goes on to say, in the original presentation of this in China, the sequence was a five-part sequence because the Chinese energy cycle is a five-phase cycle. And in the first of the five, the ox was dark, black, and progressively through the next three, there would be less and less black. It isn't like it would just be artistically fading, but it would like be that only two-thirds of it would be black, and then half, and then one-third, and then the fifth phase would be all white, so that the ox would disappear. That's the way the Chinese would see it. That's the Tao. The Tao would see it that way. That you progressively, by accurate stages, lessened your illusion. Or if you like, lessened your ability to believe in the illusion. Or if you like, heightened your ability to understand that what you were seeing is an optical illusion. It's like you've been looking all your life with crossed eyes, and you realize that you don't have to see with crossed eyes, that you can uncross your eyes, and what happens is that the world comes into focus as it really is. The reason that you couldn't see the world as it really was is because you were imagining how it would be. Because here you have crossed eyes, you can't really see it, so you imagined the world, how it should be. And when you learn to uncross your eyes and see it as it is, there was no need for the fantasy. And it's not just like the fantasy just stops, it's even more profound than that. It's as if it had never happened. Because there's no memory trace of it at all. Which is why the classical word for it was that that realm was void. It never occurred. Maya. It was only apparently there as long as you were fueling it from microsecond to microsecond with your belief. And as soon as it went away, not only did it disappear, but it never happened. There's no trace of it anywhere. There's no trace of it or flavor of it in the memory of your wholeness. And in the experience of your wholeness, nada. It's like that. But in order to engender that, in order to come up to that, one has to take this kind of super string loop of the quest to discover that there's nothing to quest for. There's nothing out there to find. It's not out there. But you have to project it as if it were out there and go through this, and if you go through it meticulously, the conviction to keep on believing in the delusion lessens step by step by step until finally you shut it off. It's just, it's as accurate as clicking off a machine. It's just turning it off. It's as accurate as that. So seeing the traces leads to the third one, seeing the ox. Remember now, we're starting on this mystery tape loop that actually starts with the astonishment that something has happened and you don't know what, and then the second and the third, seeing the ox, and then the fourth and the fifth, catching the ox and herding the ox. Catching the ox and herding the ox. I'm not going to go into this commentary right now. I'll go into it next week. That'll be more appropriate because there are a lot of errors in the commentary. Suzuki presents it right, but the traditional commentary is misleading. It's culturally skewed in such a way that it's not useful. Notice here, coming home on the ox's back, number six. Coming home on the ox's back. So that from seeing the traces, you have one, two, three, four, five. That's the original Chinese Taoist presentation. Two, three, four, five, six. Two, three, four, five, six. That's the five in which the ox would be progressively less colored black and more just the white outline and white shape. So that when the person coming home, the person would be riding home on an ox that wasn't there. That by the time number five, herding the ox, was accomplished, one could ride home on an ox that was no longer there. So that you would be coming home as you were. You could say you're coming home riding an ox, but you're coming home as you are. That would be the Chinese traditional Taoist presentation of an understanding. The Japanese Zen presentation of it includes the first one, and then the seventh one, the ox forgotten, leaving the man alone. Part of the Japanese psyche is that is to underscore the obvious, making the obvious obvious. It's both the genius and also the bane of the Japanese personality, to make the obvious obvious, to underscore it. And it's great when you underscore it once, and it becomes tedious when you underscore it 200 times. But it's important in this Rinzai Zen wide openness to not only know, but as it were, to exponentially know that you know. To put an exclamation mark after the experience of gnosis, to jump it. To not only emotionally have the realization, but to have it in spades. Not only to have, as Zen language would say, a moment of satori, but to have enlightenment, which is that moment of satori extended to all time and all space. But it reads here, the caption, "The ox forgotten, leaving the man alone." And it's the underscoring of what happens in the sixth version in terms of the Chinese. Then the eighth picture, the ox and the man both gone out of sight. So that the eighth stage here is the symbolic presentation of what happens ritually in the first stage. The ritual astonishment in the first stage is finally amplified and culminated in the symbolic astonishment of the eighth stage. The ox and the man are both gone. There was nothing to seek. There was nothing to find. What occurred always is there, and doesn't just happen in a time frame. It's always there. And it doesn't happen in a piecemeal, it's the entirety of it. And it doesn't happen to you, it is you, in your entirety, in your eternal entirety, if I can use that kind of language. So that the eighth, the ox and the man both gone out of sight, is just the blank circle. What this tape loop of the journey has done is to run the gamut through the entire psyche. The entire psyche. And that when the entire psyche has been gone through so that one can experience it as a whole, the entire psyche can be expressed symbolically as a blank circle. But that blank circle does not occur. It's like the blank circle also is not an objective thing. So what happens is that when that blank circle experience occurs, nature blinks back into focus. So you have the ninth, returning to the origin, back to the source, back to nature. But not just back to nature, but nature occurs again in its primordiality. It is just as it is. But notice the mystery here, which we're always trying to keep in mind. Nature is not an objective phenomenon, but is a transformational process. So that one just doesn't come back and then nature is there and that's it. One isn't like a rock in nature. There is no such thing as that either, because nature is a transformational process. So that one has then the tenth, entering the city with bliss bestowing hands. And this version that we have, you can see the tenth here. That is to say, we participate in the transformational process, which is nature. But our participation is, I guess the term I need to use here is holistic. It's not the best language, but it's the one I want to use. We are utterly of that process. Whatever we do, then, whatever we are, is au naturel, completely. The phrase in the Huainanzi, quoted from Chuangzi, is joy and anger occurring as naturally as the four seasons. So this is a basic presentation symbolically of this primal ritual occurrence. That is to say, all ritual comportment has as its basic theme this process. So all effective rituals in their primordial integrity take us at a juncture of our lives where our existential wholeness or reality is at stake, and take us through a circuit to assure us and bring us back that we are a part of the cosmos still. We're part of nature still, even with this happening to us. What are, the question then, intelligently, what are those nodes of experience where ritual is indispensable? And they are, in the famous phrase and words of a writer named Van Gennep, a Dutch writer, they are the rites of passage. Birth, maturation, marriage, religious transformation, and death. The basic rites of passage in a life cycle where at that node the whole existential reality of oneself is challenged, as it were. Challenged by what? Challenged by the possibility that you might go astray, that you might leave the sacred realm which has been carved out and protected by the religious protection of our people since time immemorial, that you might profane yourself by being so upset by this node of challenge that you would go astray. And so to take you on a shortcut journey of that going astray and then led back in so that you are re-included again in the sacred, in your new enlarged capacity. When you're sexually mature, when you marry, when you're spiritually mature, when you die, when you are born. So that is an ecology which is primordial to the ritual comportment. And because these events actually happen, are real. They're real in time and space and life. One is actually born. One actually has a sexual maturity. One actually can't have that kind of a marriage. One can actually have a spiritual maturity. One actually dies. Because these nodes are real, the ritual level, the ritual phase is real. It's because of this. They're not imaginative happenings. They're not fictive happenings. They're not happenings which are there because of a cultural ethos. They actually do occur. They are real. And so the ritual level is real because of that. Nature is real, but nature is real in terms of a flow. And it's like language is real, but in terms of its flow. But in the ritual level, there are junctures There are phases, there are times, there is the moment, which is real. That 1 minute before is different from 1 minute after. One has changed. And it isn't just an arithmetic change. It isn't like just adding something. But it's a geometric change. It's an exponential change. One has another dimension. So you can think of it this way, that while you have, I'm going to use a kind of a poetic language here for a moment. While in nature you have the regular three-dimensional world to live in, as you go through these rites of passage, you add more dimensions, more dimensionality. By the time you get really matured, you might be a seven or eight-dimensional person. And of course, on really sophisticated levels, there's not only death, but there's rebirth, the afterlife, which gives you another dimension there. So that being human, the reality of being human, has at different junctures different realms, different worlds, which are real. They are all real, but as we grow and as we experience and as we change, we leave one world and enter another, and leave that and enter another. And so the thresholds at these worlds are the rites of passage. And these are the nodes by which the ritual comportment is real. So you can see how important this is, and that to misunderstand this, to not know this, to not have a sensitivity for this, is the very basis of ignorance. In fact, if the ritual level is not real to oneself, if one is bound up in illusion and ignorance and fantasy, none of the rites of passage actually occur, including in a weird retrospect way, in a recursive way, one has never even been born. Someone who would be 100% totally mad, totally crazy, is literally and factually someone who has never been born, whose birth is negated by the fictiveness, the fantasy. In Buddhism, this is called the Avishi hell, and it takes a very great bodhisattva to rescue someone out of that, to go back to their condition before they are born, and to help them get born again, so they can begin the journey, even in any kind of a way. And just as there are Avishi hell, there are very great bodhisattvas who love doing this, who are made exactly to do this. The universe does not have a condition for which there is no cure. You can never be challenged more than 100% of your capacity. Thank goodness it's usually only about 99%. But even at the worst, it's only 100%. You can only fill up to here. You cannot fill up beyond the Sahasrara chakra. That's always sacred turf. And if you have your spirit about you, and you can inhabit that space above the Sahasrara chakra, you can fill up 100% with anxiety and watch it fill, and then watch it fade back again, because it doesn't have any staying power. It doesn't stay very long. It's like an embarrassment. it's like a psychic embarrassment. It lasts for about as long as you would stay embarrassed, and then it recedes all by itself. It's very peculiar to see that happen. And for someone who is in that kind of a condition, they're portrayed with a halo, with a nimbus, like that. They are holy in that sense, and one could make a pun on words and say that they were W-H-O-L-L. They are holy themselves. There's a play on those words. The wholeness becomes the holy when one adds the aspirant to it, emphasizes the aspirant, emphasizes the fact of it. I want to give you one last thing, and we'll call it a day. I want to give you in translation a song, and this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 characters, 7 mnemonic emblems, one of which is just a sign for a rest, a pause in the language, which is just as important as anything one would say. This is a chant which in the Algonquin spiritual initiation that you would be told, it would be chanted directly to you when you were in the condition which we are in today. When your sense of reality is heightened and yet you don't have the staying power to maintain it, and that when you're going to go out the door and down the steps and into the street, it's going to seem more and more like, what did he say? Like that. This is a chant that you would be given. It's in translation. The word for spirit in Algonquin is manito. Manito, manito. A spirit, you who sit there, you who sit there. The fog wind goes from place place, wherever the wind blows, rest. I who acknowledge you to be a spirit and am dying, I am trying you who are the bear. It's not the ox, but the bear in the Algonquin. The bird, the crow bird's skin is the reason why I am a spirit. The sound of the thunder is the white bear of fire. In nature, all bears are black. So to have a white bear of fire is that spiritual bear to that nth degree. The flaming spirit of truth. This also is in the Smithsonian. This is the 7th annual report. I'll leave these things open and you can take a look at them. Thanks for making it.